Welcome to Crosstalk. Today I have a really special guest. We've done dozens and dozens and dozens of podcasts, and I've interviewed people that I know very well, and I've interviewed people I don't know at all. Today I'm interviewing somebody that I just met today, somebody that I spoke to a few times before, but I've never been as excited to talk to somebody as I am to talk to Matt Bocci, who's here to talk with us today about his story. Before I introduce Matt, I just want to ask you to subscribe, like, ring that bell so that we know that you're listening, and ask us what you want, tell us what you want, give us your comments so that we know that we're being heard and we want to give you more good content. But in the meantime, it might be a good time to introduce Matt. So why don't we start doing that? Matt, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on Crosstalk. I'm honored to have you at the Crosstalk mic.
Yeah, and it's an honor to be here. Honor to be sitting at this table with you.
You have a story that's very interesting, a story that's, I think, different than most because of some of the things that happened before you got into drugs and alcohol. Typically, we focus on how you started drinking or drugging, how one started to cross the line, what happened, and how did you get your act together? But today we're going to dig a little bit more into some of the early years than people might usually want to share, because some of the things that occurred, I've read your story. By the way, Matt has a book called Sway. We'll talk a little bit of that at the end, but I want everybody to go to Amazon and buy Sway. I did. You grew up in New Jersey, right?
Yeah, I grew up in New Jersey, small town called Morristown, New Jersey. A small town next to Morristown, New Jersey.
So even smaller than
an even smaller town than Morristown, New Jersey. Morristown's not too small of a town, but I grew up in a small town right near there.
And in growing up, what did growing up look like? Did you have siblings? And
yeah, I'm the oldest of four boys. From a young age, I think if you viewed my childhood, you could maybe argue it was a borderline white picket fence upbringing, but it really wasn't. My dad came from very poor Italian immigrant parents and was taught at a young age that hard work and values and good morals would. But we grew up in a way where, of course, we were, giving gifts and whatnot, but my dad really made sure that we were working hard in school and that we were achieving in sports and extracurriculars, et cetera. And so
Four boys. And so it was mom, dad, and you were the oldest of four.
Yeah, so I was nine. My brother Nick, who's right under me, was seven, then 3 years old, and then 3 months old.
So pretty normal growing up period. You had mom and dad. Dad worked hard.
Yeah, my dad worked very, very hard, but he was very involved in our lives. I mean, he was very active in the church. He was a coach for me and my brother Nick. He was very active in the town, part of the PTA and the civic association that they had in town. And he just was always involved in our lives, especially. Now, when I say like oldest of four boys, my brother Paul was 3 months old when my dad passed away. So we had a brief period of time that summer, really, where we were a full family, and one.
And what year was that?
That was in 2001.
Okay. We want to, eliminate the first 9 years of your life. But 2001 was a kind of a important year in your arc of your life so far.
Yeah, I mean, look, if I look back at the years prior to 9 years old, I'll be honest with you. I think a lot of it for me is a blur. People often say how they remember things from when they were 5, 6, 7 years old. I don't remember many of those years personally.
Any addiction in your family?
Not that I know of. Not that I know of.
So in my family, same kind of thing. Fell off a tree. Yeah. There were fat people, and there were people that liked the one-armed bandits. People liked to shop and stuff like that. But
sure.
Workaholism, maybe, but I'm the one that fell off a tree.
And we have some of that in my family, too, probably. But I think I was the first real open case of alcoholism and addiction.
Right.
At least the showcase and.
Well, I want to congratulate you.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's an honor.
You know, there is a theory. My friend Neil from Atlanta, who's about your age, says that when you get into recovery, you're actually better off having gone through your addiction because you learn things that you never would have learned otherwise. It's kind of unusual that way, but we'll get into that. So anything in particular happened in 2001?
Yeah, so, you know, and that's obviously the life-changing moment of my life, of my childhood. I like I said, I had a very normal upbringing up until that day. But yeah, on the morning of September 11, 2001, I went to school. I had just started fourth grade a week prior. Normal day. And I remember living in Florida now, it's you don't have the change of the seasons as much, right, obviously. So that morning, the way I would describe it was that the quintessential leaving summer, entering fall in New Jersey in the tri-state area, right? Like that, like the humidity was still there, but fading. The dew was always on the ground in the morning on the grass, right? And there was a crispness in the air. That's what I remember. But they described it, the pilots described that day as severe clear because there was not a single cloud in the sky. And that's the way I remember it too. Just a beautiful, sunny, bright blue sky day. I had just entered fourth grade, and at about 9 in the morning, they pulled me out of my classroom. And what happened was the school that I went to was 2 minutes down the road from my house. Small school, I think maybe 275 total kids in the whole entire K through 8. My class was the biggest. And so the superintendent came to my classroom, and there was a little glass window in the door, in the wooden door paneling. He knocked on it and made eye contact with my teacher and walked inside. And when he walked in, he whispered something to my teacher. She points at myself and another classmate and tells us to go into the hallway. And my immediate reaction and thought is that I was in trouble, and for what, I had no idea. But
can I ask you, I've never had a superintendent come into a class. Usually it's a principal.
Yeah.
So this is a first. You never saw this guy before.
No. We all knew him very, very well. He was a very active superintendent. It's a small school. Where I grew up, like, we were fed to a public high school nearby. We didn't have our own high school.
So it wasn't that crazy that this person came into the room?
Not at all.
Okay.
But typically when he would be coming around, you would think he was a nice guy and he was a welcoming guy.
Discipline.
But you'd be exactly disciplined. So that's why I was like, did I get it? What did I do? Why am I in trouble? So I get up and I walk into the hallway. And as I do, I turn around. My teacher's following us. And when we get there, she starts whispering with my brother Nick's second grade teacher. So as we enter the hallway, there's my brother and the other classmate's younger brother and their teacher. And they huddle us together. The teachers commingle amongst each other real quick. And they tell us, we think a small plane hit your dad's building. They're evacuating the tower. Both of your dads are safe. There's nothing to worry about. And as a child, like, I looked at my brother, and I looked at my teacher, and then I look at my friend, I look at my teacher, and I'm like, okay, like, you know, I didn't question it. I just was thinking what you normally think. Your teacher's telling you what they know, and it's the truth. They're the adult, right? So I didn't question anything, and she turned to me, and she said, any questions? But the way she phrased it was like, you know, don't ask any questions type of thing, right? And so from there, they brought us to this room that we call the computer room. And that's where I started to sense that something was off, because everyone started getting taken out of school early. Parents were coming into the school, pulling their kids out. Parents are running through the hallways crying. I mean, I had never seen anything like that before in my life, and I was wondering why I was staying in school, right? I had no idea what had occurred, you know, an hour prior, which was that my dad made the first phone call to my mom 3 minutes after the plane hit. Let me backtrack. Leading up to 9/11, my dad had voiced to my mom about 2.5 weeks prior. He had what I consider a spiritual premonition, a experience, a sign, whatever you want to call it, where he finally he had enough. And he said to my mother, I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to pay down the mortgage. I want to find my true happiness in life. He didn't know what it was, but he was going to go find that. And the weekend prior, again, voicing to my mom, I'm going to quit. And then that morning, he called her at 8:49, 3 minutes after the plane hit. And he never would call during the workday. And if he ever called, it was never from his cell phone. So his cell phone caller ID pops up on the house phone. And my mom, her thought is, he finally walked out. She picks up the phone, and my dad says very calmly, you know, she said that the normal commotion and, you know, noises in the background were what she was hearing, nothing out of the ordinary. And my dad was very calm, and he just said, Michelle, do you have a TV on? We think a small plane hit the building. We're trying to evacuate now. I'm okay. And my dad was known to pull pranks.
Now, he was at Canner?
He was at Canner Fitzgerald on the 105th floor.
And that was where the first plane hit.
Plane hit. So he was in the first building. His plane hit 93 to 99. And so anyone above the impact zone in the North Tower had no way out. The South Tower, there were a couple.
Was he above?
Yeah, he was well above. He was on the 105th floor. The South Tower had a couple escapable paths, but not everyone knew that. But if you were above the impact zone in the first building, you had no way out. And so my mom says, you know, John, this better not be some sort of sick joke. And as she finishes that sentence, the line cuts off. And she, at the time, she's breastfeeding my baby brother. He was 3 months old. She puts him down. She goes into what we call the TV room, changes the channel on the TV, and sees the smoke coming out of my dad's building and starts freaking out. And she's calling his cell phone. He'd pick up, but she'd hear nothing but static. My dad would call her. She'd pick up, nothing but static. Back and forth, this went for probably about maybe 10 minutes max, 5 to 10 minutes max. And my dad got through to her one last time, and she picked up, and he just said, Michelle, I don't know if you can hear me. You're the love of my life, and I'll love you forever. And my mom started screaming, you know, John, I love you, I love you, and the line cut off, and that was it. She couldn't get through to him anymore. My dad's brother, my uncle Tony, he woke up to hearing the sounds of his mother, my grandmother, screaming. And like I said, these Italian immigrant parents my dad had. My uncle runs upstairs in their house in Fort Lee, New Jersey, and he goes into this little foyer area where they have a small little TV. He sees my nonna pointing at the television, seeing the smoke coming out of my dad's building. And he knew immediately my dad was not going to get out. And he runs into the kitchen, and he starts calling my dad's cell phone. He tried his office phone first, wouldn't connect. Then he starts calling the cell phone, and it's just not ringing. And he said he kept calling over and over and over and over. And then all of a sudden, it started ringing. And my dad picked up the phone, and he just calmly said, hello. And my uncle was like, John, get out. And my dad just said, Tony, I love you. And line cut off, and that was the last person that we know of that spoke to him. And from that point on, basically, like, the cell phone stopped working.
And going back to the school, people are crying, people are taking their kids out of the school, and you're in the computer room with your brother. Anybody else in there?
Those two kids that were with me, their dad worked on the 33rd floor. He got out no problem. They got taken out of school early too. So eventually it was just, I felt like it was just me and my brother there alone. When we got on that bus to go home from school, go home from the end of the school day, I felt like we were the only kids on the bus, you know, and there could have been maybe one or two more, but the way I remember it was we just were by ourselves.
You knew that there's something going on. You didn't know exactly what.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a good thing.
I had that feeling. And then when we got off the bus, we started walking up the hill to the house. And that's where I knew something had happened.
And you're the oldest.
I'm the oldest.
What are you telling your younger brother?
I mean, listen, at the same time, I was going through it myself. So I really wasn't sitting there consoling him because I didn't really know what was going on. And at that point, like, you sensed something was off, but you just didn't know it yet. It wasn't confirmed. So when we walked up to the house, that's where I saw 40-plus cars at least in the driveway, on the lawn. It was a very weird scene for me to kind of take in and absorb. And we walked through the garage, and then we walk into the house, and as we're walking down this little corridor area to the kitchen, I turn to the corner, and that's where, like, the kitchen opened up, and I saw, like, family members in this corner, family friends in that corner, and people were hysterically crying. And that's, I had never seen so many adults in one setting besides a funeral crying. Something was off. And I kept walking, and I walked into the TV room again, and there's a couch and people are watching the television, and there's a family friend sitting there holding the remote in her hand. And I turn and I start watching the footage myself. And this is about 3:30 in the afternoon, and more footage was coming out at this point, but they are showing the montage, the replay from that morning, right? So at that point, the first plane's impact wasn't shown on television until later that evening. Filmed by these French brothers who were filming a documentary for this firefighter crew. They had at that time, only footage of the first building being hit by the first plane, my dad's building. So at this point, they're showing the building, my dad's building, on fire. The second plane hits the second building. The buildings both come down. And when that montage ends, the family friend changes the channel on the TV. And when she does, it goes to another news station that's now showing other footage, and it's an image of someone falling to their death, a video of someone falling to
somebody
their death.
Somebody jumping.
Someone jumping, falling. And as a child, that is what I the moment I saw that, like, the way it was described to me, at least, was my grandmother witnessed that I saw it, my mom witnessed that I saw it, and my reaction was just very emotional, and that was the part of the whole entire, what I saw in that 5 minutes of watching.
Were you crying?
Yeah, I was crying, and I just couldn't understand it, truthfully. Like, I had been in the World Trade Center so many times, so for me to see that and, like, also know, even as a kid, how high up that building is, when you see someone falling in the air like that, it just, you can't compute what you're seeing. It just doesn't, it's just not making sense.
I remember being in Windows of the World, all the way up on top, the restaurant that was up there. I think I was up there once or twice.
Yeah.
That was as tall as it got at
the
time.
Right. I think many people don't know that, and this is where I like to try to educate too, because where my dad worked and I had been there so many times. But so Cantor Fitzgerald occupied floors 101 to 105. And then 106 and 107 was Windows on the World. 106 was where the Windows on the World restaurant was. 107 is where the catering and events would occur for Windows on the World. So Cantor Fitzgerald had their Christmas parties there every single year. That's where we would go. 108, 109, and 110, it's a 110-story building. Those three floors were electrical floors and so on, such and such. So anyway, as a child, as 9 years old, seeing it, I see where they're coming from. It's well above the impact zone. To this day, can picture the video. I've seen this video hundreds of times, thousands of times. But that's the defining moment to me of 9/11, because for one, it encapsulated, in my opinion, the horror of that day. I think that people go into New York City, they go to the memorial, and they don't understand in full that area was a legit war zone. Besides the fact that planes are impacting, jetliners are impacting buildings in downtown Manhattan, skyscrapers, right? People are jumping to their deaths from 1,300 feet in the air because that's the easiest, the better way out, right? I don't think people really understood that unless they were there or grew up in that. The rest of the country certainly didn't understand that. You know, I've gone to places to speak where I talk about 9/11. You'd think I'm talking about something that happened in another country.
Yeah,
right?
they weren't alive.
Well, the fact that they weren't alive is one piece of it, but like even places that I go to, like I've spoken at conferences in Midwest that like it just does not impact people the same. Like our lives were changed forever as a country, as a world, right? But if you didn't grow up in that area or like knew someone in that area or were living there at the time, it just didn't hit you the same.
Right. It's the same thing when you hear about natural disasters, whether they're outside of the area that you live in or outside of the United States.
Right.
You feel bad that something bad happened, but within 10, 15, 20 seconds, you're going about your life. But the impact of these things are life-changing. They never go away, really.
Right.
You learn how to deal with them, but they don't go away.
Right.
So you're a little boy, and you're finding out that your dad's not coming home. There's a funeral? There's a memorial service or something? Because they don't have the remains of your father at this point.
They found him. We were very fortunate to this day, still are very fortunate for this, but they found him 4 days later, or 3 days later. It's weird because I wear his watch, and so he wasn't wearing the watch that day. He had another one that he was wearing. They found him on the 14th. When my mom gifted me that watch, mind you, it was in a safety deposit box for years. It had stopped, and the time and the date that it stopped to was the 14th. I don't know if it was from the 14th of September 2001. I'd like to imagine that it was, because that watch was not worn for years. Found that very strange. But they found him on the 14th. They came to the house on the 18th to tell us that they found him. Where we were very lucky was that my family friend / neighbor was a dentist who was identifying people down there by their dental records. And so when everything happens, my mom gives a toothbrush, a hairbrush.
For DNA.
And then I forget what she gave some other stuff too. that they asked for. And when he was found, she had a lot of questions. And they couldn't answer all the questions initially because they were just inundated. They weren't finding many people.
Most people, yeah. Right. I remember in New York, there were boards, like mock-up poster boards all over New York City.
Missing posters.
Yeah, with people saying, if you see this person.
Yeah.
People, there were efforts to try to know what happened. A lot of people didn't know what happened.
And that's the thing. Like, we had those missing posters, too. I mean, you see those pictures. I mean, it's horrible. You know, you see the old footage from that time, like, where they took pictures of those posters everywhere. I mean, it's tragic. No one knew. And the thing is, like, not everyone was fortunate enough to have a phone call. You know, my people that were on my dad's desk, here's another thing, too, as you probably remember, not everyone had cell phones back then. So my dad getting through on the cell phone, my dad was passing that cell phone around to other people. Kid that he mentored, who then he hired full-time a day before 9/11, called his parents, and they grew up in my town. And he said, you know, Mom, like, he was like, Mom, Dad, like, you know, plane hit our building. And they're like, okay, you know, get out. He's like, no, like, I don't think you understand. Like, I'm calling to say goodbye. Like, so hearing that phone call, like them telling me that phone call, right, it seems to me like they accepted their fate. And his dad asked, what are you guys doing? He said, we're saying the Lord's Prayer. He's like, I got to go. I got to pass the phone. So I would like to think it was my dad's phone, because I know dad's phone stopped working. I don't know, right? We're very close to that family, though. So hearing these stories, I tried piecing together all this missing time, right? From that last phone call to the time the building collapsed, I wanted to know his whereabouts. And so that's like, we find him. They come to the house a week later. We bury him a few days after that. And it was supposed to be my piece of my closure, and it was just the beginning in many ways. It was the beginning of a long, long journey.
I keep thinking that about how your dad felt then, and that you're almost his age now.
Yeah.
That he was then.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no way anybody at any age could know how to handle this situation. But he knew enough to call your mom and say that you're the love of my life.
Yeah.
And he knew that he was not going to be surviving this.
Yeah.
And now that you're that age, it seems to me that he was a pretty brave guy who, he wasn't crying or screaming or whatever. He kind of knew what was going on and wanted her to know that she was the one person that made his life wonderful.
Yeah, and that's what I say often, you know, when I tell my story, is like, in the face of adversity, in the face of death, he did not let anyone close to him know. You know, I'll choke up here and there when I tell the story, but it's like, you know, when his brother called him, got through to him, it's like, you know, like, he didn't show any sign of fear. And to me, like, that defines him as a man in many ways. Like, not to say that people who showed more emotions, in a sense, on those last phone calls that they made were weak, because they're not, you know, but like, he didn't want them to know that he was scared. And I know he probably was, but he handled it with bravery and courage, you know?
And his son, who's sitting across from me right now, is here on a podcast about to become the most transparent of guests and just tell us all what's going on inside.
Yeah.
Which is pretty brave, too.
Yeah. It does. I don't give myself enough credit for that. And it takes a lot of guts to say the stuff that I talk about the stuff that I say. I mean, it's not easy. But I do know in my heart that it is going to help someone. One person, 10 people, 100 people, if it helps one, that to me, it was worth it. I was told that since day one when I started telling my story. If you can help one person, and along the way, people keep saying, just one makes it all worth it to you. And I'm like, yeah.
Before we started the podcast, I told you about Matt Butler.
Yeah.
Matt Butler goes around to prisons with his guitar. He's a talented songwriter and musician, and he's in recovery, and he sings songs, and my favorite song of his is called Just One, If You Can Help Just One. So, you know, I highly recommend listening to it. It's exactly the same idea. The other thing that comes to mind is Muhammad Ali said, it's not about being on top. It's what you do when you get knocked on your ass that matters.
And that's a very similar quote. I think it's by, who said it? Confucius said it. My mom took a picture of this plaque that was in my sober living when I checked in. and I celebrated a year sober, and she gives me another version of that same saying, and it's, and it wraps around on the plaque, and it says, "Our greatest glory is not never falling, but rising every time we fall." And that, to me, is the epitome of my story and my life. Because, you know, I can certainly admire the fact that I shouldn't be here to tell my story for all the, you know, the stuff that we'll get into in a minute here. But to me, it's greater than drugs and alcohol. It's the other stuff. I shouldn't be here for that stuff, right? Because the reality is I was so broken. And now I heard this the other day at a conference that I spoke at. Someone said, "You're broken open." And that's, I like to view it in that way now, because it's what it is, right? I am an open book. And I think that I viewed myself as being this shattered, broken kid for so long. And I've changed the way that I view. I pivoted the way I view that. My outlook has completely shifted. And that, I think, has allowed me to be even more transparent than I've always been, because I really just don't care what anyone thinks about me, you know?
See, that is, at the end of the day, the thing that gives us the biggest freedom, is to not give a fuck about what anybody else thinks. That doesn't mean that you don't care about people or you don't want to be loved, but not to live your life in a way that you're making every move to make somebody else happy or to get somebody to think a certain way about you. What they think about me is none of my business.
Right.
You know, you've heard that before.
Right.
And I think the other thing is that transparency really transforms us from being broken to being fixed in many ways. Doesn't mean things aren't going to be difficult. We're not going to have other challenges. People are going to get sick. Things are not going to go the way we want all the time. People are going to say things to us that we don't like, that hurt us. But at the end of the day, we're going to be able to deal with all that stuff. It's, you know, daring. I think it's Brené Brown that talks about daring to be seen and how important it is to be okay to be seen and to have the strength and courage to do that.
Right.
So, so you just going back a little bit into the earlier years. So you're now realize that Dad's not coming home. His remains have been given to you. You have a funeral service, I suppose. What did things look like in the post 9/11 era? Like, take us through a little bit of the growing up years. You're now in elementary school. You go through middle school and high school. Just give us a little bit of that.
I mean, it was mainly trying to live a relatively normal childhood, right? It's no surprise that we had a label. You know, I mentioned that other family, that kid, he was 23 years old when he died 9/11. His name was Matt Salito. I'm saying his name so it's not forgotten. And besides him and my dad, there was no other people from my town. So we went to my middle school, and as I mentioned earlier, it was a small school. So to me, I just felt like there was always this label associated with me and my brothers and anywhere we went, because we were called the children of 9/11. And so I just felt like I struggled immensely with that label, because I felt like I'd never be anything more than just that. And so, you know, like, and this was kind of, I don't want to say proven, but it was validated in many ways over the years. Like, as I got a little bit older, I was on the Oprah Winfrey show. The title of the show was called The Children of 9/11, right? And so how do you expect a kid to grow up and not have everything in their lives associated with that fate, just that one day? You know, there's 364 days for the rest of the year. That one day defined everything for me. So I tried my best, and I strived to be a normal kid, but I struggled to do that. I had no problem fitting in. I had friends. I played sports. I was a popular kid. I didn't, you know, that was not a problem.
But that label was always on your back.
Label was on my back, and deep down, I was this hurt little boy who just wanted to be seen, you know?
And you wanted your daddy, too.
That, too. You know, I mean, growing up without a father at that young of an age it could really mess a kid up. And it did for me.
You know, when I was a kid, and I remember I had a friend who lost his father when we were in elementary school, and he was the kid whose father died. He didn't have a father, and everybody else had a father. And that was a label that, and this person ended up being my law partner, and still to this day, close friend, his two kids' weddings. I was just at one of his kids' weddings in August. But he was the kid who lost his father when we were in sixth grade. And I can imagine that that kind of label was kind of a soft label. It was like embroidered in your back. It wasn't just written.
It was, yeah, exactly. And when you grow up in a small town like that too, where you're the only ones, I think there was just a lot of, I felt pitied when I didn't want to be pitied. I felt at times judged when I didn't want to be judged. And really at the end of the day, like I just wanted to be a normal kid. Right. And not, I didn't want people to be friends with me because my dad died 9/11. All right. I didn't want people to not be mean to me because my dad died on 9/11. Right. Remember we went to a church, one of the anniversaries, probably, I think I was in like sixth or seventh grade. It wasn't at my church. It was at the neighboring church. And the way that church was, the design inside was there was like a lot of pews on the upper level. And I remember looking back and there was like a row of girls from my school and they're all just staring at me during this memorial mass. And that to me was like, that's how I can remember those middle school years, was that moment. Like they weren't looking at the mass, they weren't looking at the priest, they weren't sitting there listening or listening to the hymn, you know.
They wanted to get a glimpse of the person who went through that.
Yeah.
You know, the funny thing is it's very hard for the other people too.
Of course.
They don't know what the hell to do with it either, especially kids.
No, yeah.
Is there anything that gave you relief in those early years?
Before drugs?
Before drugs.
Sports. Sports. I was athletic as a kid. I was a good soccer player. So I was always trying to challenge myself. My crew of friends, my closest crew of friends, we played soccer together since we were in fourth grade. And so it was like where we grew up, again, small town, we would try out for the traveling teams in the towns over. So I try to put that challenge to my friends, to myself, like, let's try out for this team instead. They're a better team. You know, and it was like that competitiveness was always in me. That's the thing. Like, I had this shift, as a lot of kids do. No matter what happens to you as a kid, normal upbringing, dad dies tragically. I had that normal shift as I got a little bit older where it was like the same kids that I hung out with since I was in fourth grade, doing the most basic stuff, playing soccer in the backyard, playing video games, you know, 2v2 Madden in the basement. Like, that was my childhood. And then all of a sudden, you get a little bit older, a little bit older, a little bit older, and then boom, you hit that eighth grade into high school level, and you're like, I want to change the way I feel, right? I want to drink, or I have to drink in order to hang out.
How old were you when you first started that?
14 years old. I just turned 14, you know, and I was a baby. Like,
how'd you steal that from whom?
We just graduated from eighth grade, and my friends, they were triplets, but the twin, you know, the boys I was close with, they were my crew, and still are. We had a party at their house and they stole the 30 pack from their older brother. And that was it. Like, we started drinking these beers and they were warm Coors Lights or Natty Lights. It was disgusting. And I weighed 100 and maybe 20 pounds soaking wet at that time. I threw up after three beers. I hated it. And I woke up the next day and I was like, I don't want to do this again. And the next time I did it, I was like, that's actually not too bad. You know, and I started, but the thing is, I'd be lying to you if I told you that when I started drinking, I felt relief, immense relief. I felt some relief, but it wasn't my I had arrived moment. When I first started smoking weed, yeah, I felt a lot more of that, right? The noises and the voices in my head, I was able to shut off a little bit easier, you know, and I was going through all this stuff as a growing kid, right? And questioning and drinking and then...
Anybody watching what you were doing or being aware of what you were doing, or were you very good hiding it?
I was extremely good at hiding it, like arguably too good at hiding it because, you know, my mom, I think it's been 9 years since I've been sober. I think she's a little, I don't want to say naive, but I think she like wants to pretend like the bad years didn't occur, maybe to pretend it didn't happen. I just filmed a TV thing that was supposed to be coming out last year for an A&E show called Addiction Unplugged. And when we were filming it, they don't prompt her and ask her what, tell her what questions they're going to ask her. So they said, do you have any like memories of him like drinking or doing this, that, the other thing in high school? And she goes, no, he was like the greatest kid. I'm like, Mom, you don't know because I never came home. I would go to Sully's, like my best friend's house. I would go to his house and stay. Like his mom was the one catching us with the beer breath and, you know, when we're spraying Listerine in our mouth and putting the Listerine strips in our mouth. So I hit it so well. And also the reality is she had just gotten remarried. She's raising three other boys. Me, I had straight A's. I was playing sports. Like everything on the outside was like the golden boy, the oldest child. He's good. We don't have to worry about him. And meanwhile, I was struggling so much inside.
Right. And was anybody doing therapy in those years? Or
we did therapy since day one. Yes, yeah. Since day one. We started off doing group therapy as a family. Then we did individuals. Then group as brothers. Groups with my mom. Like just one brother with the mom. My mom. You know, we did every variation of it.
But still, with the alcohol and drugs, that wasn't something that you ever shared when you were in a therapy session.
You know, I'd share that I was drinking and smoking, but I never shared, like... I shared just enough, and I think they looked at it and said, you know what, like, this is just a normal kid, right? Like, he's trying to be a normal kid. And that's the thing, like, I think that... in the beginning, I was drinking. Like I was not I was an alcoholic, but it had not showcased itself just yet. It hadn't surfaced.
You hadn't crossed the line yet.
Not yet. No. I mean, look, and then I look at what's going on in my life at that time, and that's when I'm really questioning my father's death and questioning my mother as to what she thought happened to him inside that building, and she had no way of knowing. Questioning my dad's brother, the person that we know of, is the last to speak to him, and the two of them convene and say, look, we can't do this anymore. You're 14 years old. You're just harming yourself. You're not going to grow. You know, you need to move on. And they weren't telling me to forget. They were like, you got to move forward, though. And I have an uncle at that time through marriage who steps in and he's like, look, you know, for about 2 years prior was already saying weird stuff to me. And, you know,
what does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, like, he would just, you know, you mentioned that we talked offline before, like, you know, with the camp counselor thing. Like, he was like, you, let's say you're at your friend's house, your buddy's house, you wake up and he's jerking you off or he's blowing you. Are you going to let him finish you off or something like that? He'd ask questions like that. And he'd ask
questions, personal questions about you.
He'd make up scenarios and things like that. And then he would ask me, like, you know, girls that I was dating at the time. And I was like a kid, right? Oh, are you, you know, doing explicit things with the girls? Like, you know, are you just kissing? Like, he was just trying to get stuff out of me. And I just viewed it as, like, all right, he's trying to be funny. Like, he always had this dark humor, but, like, I never questioned it too much.
So he's asking questions, personal questions of things that you had never been asked by another adult. But
never,
he was giving you attention, though.
He's giving me attention, and the reality is, like, I wasn't some, you know, I wasn't, like, some forgotten kid either. He was giving the same attention that he would give to any of my cousins, my brothers. Like, you know, this was just who he was. Like, he... When this came to light years later, everyone was surprised because he was such a funny guy. It was like you wouldn't take it seriously because it was like, just his humor, just weird.
So what age were you when this uncle through marriage began to befriend you and you know, start lay the groundwork?
I remember where we were. So like I was roughly 12 years old and the conversations then were basic stuff. You know, about my dad, asking about my dad. And then over the span of 2 years, like, he got more direct with certain things when it came to, like, sexuality type stuff, like asking me about girls and things I was doing with girls, girls I was dating, et cetera. And essentially everything took a turn, and for him, you know, worked in his favor. Because as I'm starting to drink and smoke and, you know, try to be normal and whatnot, so to speak. I got cut off from my mother and my dad's brother regarding 9/11 and the questions I had. And at this point in time, I'm obsessed with trying to figure out what happened to my father. So every day I'm coming home from school, I'm drinking, I'm smoking, but my addiction is 9/11. It's looking at the footage over and over and over again, thinking I'm going to find my dad in a photo, in a video potentially. I mean, there's countless pictures of the Cantor Fitzgerald floors of people hanging out of the windows. And I was zooming in these photos and enhancing the photos and thinking I could find him because countless other family members had done the same. And so I reached out to photographers in New York City that took some of the most prominent 9/11 photos to this day.
Were they cooperative?
They never responded. I asked them if they would meet me, and I would go to their galleries in the city. So I was going to school, a school that was about 45 minutes from my house where I grew up, and I took the train to school. If I kept going on that train,
going to the city.
I would go into the city. So I knew how to get into the city. And so.
So why do you suppose these people didn't respond? Do you think they just didn't want to get involved emotionally?
Yeah, I just think that for them to receive the emails that I was sending at 14 years old, like.
It's too heavy for them.
It's too heavy. Like.
No money, too heavy.
I just think that with a widow reaching out in the early years of 9/11, right?
They had enough.
It was just a lot for them to absorb that and take on that person's emotions and.
They wanted to move on to things that were, you know, putting them where they wanted to be. And
but also, too, like, I just think, how do you talk to a child about that? Like, you know.
It's too much.
It's a lot. So I'm grateful to this day that they never responded. But, you know, so my uncle and my mom, they cut off those communications. And this uncle who had been grooming me, finally is like, whatever you want to talk about regarding your dad's death, I'll talk to you about it. And basically the way it kind of occurred was he's driving me home from school, from soccer practice, and we're in this truck, and I remember we're just coming around this bend, and I asked him, I'm like, do you think my dad jumped? And he's like, no, I don't think your dad jumped. First he said, he kind of hesitated, but he was like, well, he had no way out. So I just kind of left it at that. The next car ride, same bend, you know? And I just said it again. I'm like, do you think my dad jumped? And he was like, without any hesitation this time, he's like, no, I don't think your dad jumped. I know your dad jumped. And him saying that, like, just took me, it caught me so off guard. And I remember I was looking out the window. As I'm looking out the window, he leaned over and started fondling me and touching me. And I am looking out the window, and I'm, like, just not processing that that's occurring. Like, I feel it, but, like, I pushed his hand away, and I'm just thinking to myself, like, not that is that not what's going on is that's not on my mind. It's like, he's telling me my dad jumped. Okay. My dad jumped. Someone finally told me the truth that I felt was being withheld from me. And now I'm going to find him. I'll find him in a photo.
And he had no idea what he was doing. He was just after like whatever pleasure he wanted.
His own predatory desires. Yeah. And you know, it had nothing to do with trying to help me or, and I think in the beginning, maybe he came from a place of years prior, came from a place of love, if you want to call it that. Or
did you find out that he had been abused, or did that not matter, or nobody?
There was not, he wasn't sexually abused. The thing I did find out, though, was that he had abused kids when he was a child.
Right.
I mean, so that was the whole thing, too, right? Like, people, when I came forward about being abused, there's a reason why men, I think, don't want to come forward about being abused. Multiple reasons. One is the stigma, right? I'm a heterosexual male, and I have plenty of gay friends. I have nothing against anyone and what they, you know, who they're interested in. But as a heterosexual male and going to an all-boys school, you go to a school like that and you come forward about being abused, they're going to call you every name under the book, and you already go to a school that's filled with a toxic masculine culture. There's the last thing you want to do.
So if you're the victim, you're kind of don with the name that you must be homosexual.
Correct.
If you've been abused.
Correct.
So and you that, shut up and you don't say anything.
You don't
anything.
Say a word. And then the other part of it too is the other aspect of it, like, well, if this happens too, does that mean you're going to do it to someone else? And like for me, like, you know, someone said this to me, like, I'd really hope, like, you know, like if you were feeling like something that you would never want to do that to, I'm like, how could you ever say that? Like, I could never imagine first of all, I don't have that desire, right? But second of all, I can never even imagine putting any kid, person through something like that, like what I went through. You know, like, I mean, it takes a sick, like, that's a disease. You know, people who do that stuff, it's a disease.
Right.
So that's another reason why I didn't come forward, was because when I did, people, I think, automatically assume, like, yeah, this, he's going to go on to abuse, and that's how the cycle goes. But that's not actually how it works.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle was physically abused, and he lived in a household where there was domestic abuse and violence. And I knew that, but I did find out that, you know, years later, when
you,
I came
You forward, weren't the only one.
No, I wasn't the only one, but I found out that when he was 17 years old, he had abused kids who were 9, 8, you know, and so, like, and that's how it's always been sort of in the research I've done and the reading I've done into it to understand the effect it has on a kid, on a boy. people who are abusive in that way are abusive usually at a young age.
Now, I'm curious, did your drinking and drugging increase as a result of you having been the victim of this?
Yeah, it increased pretty much immediately. There were a couple of times where abuse occurred where I was under the influence. You know, I suffered a lot of nightmares as a child,
right,
regarding 9/11. I then started suffering nightmares regarding the abuse. So I increased my intake of substances. But all throughout high school, it was drinking and smoking. That's it. And when I got to college, that's where everything took a shift, a real shift. I have ADD. So my entire childhood, they told me, you got to be on Ritalin, Adderall, et cetera. Back then, they were prescribing those medications effortlessly to any kid who was showing any signs of ADD.
Just to raise your hand.
I was a very distracted kid. I would distract my classmates. I would tap on my desk. I would whistle in class. But when it came time to do my work, I would do it. When it came time to do my homework, I get it done. When it came time to pay attention in class, I would do it once I was kind of reprimanded, right? But I acted out a lot. And I think that's a direct result of what I was going through with my dad's death. But I never took those medications because I had good grades. And so when I got to college, I couldn't keep up with grades the way I used to. And I was introduced to Adderall my freshman year. And as someone who needed it and honestly could benefit from it today, I took that medication the first time. And about 20 minutes later, I texted the kid who gave it to me. And I said, this is amazing. Why doesn't everyone do it? He said, it's college. Everyone does. And I would go on to continue buying the pills from him and taking them. And with someone who has ADD and ADHD, a medication that I actually needed, it eventually did what it was supposed to do. And it would not give me any sort of euphoric high. It would shut off the noise and allow me to be normal and calm, right? And
Adderall is actually the most abused drug by lawyers.
I don't doubt it at all. And so I go home that summer because at that point, I'm not taking it. I'm not popping it. I'm snorting them to get that sort of feeling of a high and get that euphoric feeling. And I was getting it then. I get it prescribed that summer. I go back to school my sophomore year. And sophomore year is where my journey with drug addiction and abuse of substances was, I was at a fork in the road, and I took the road not less traveled, right? I was the opposite. I stopped taking the Adderall. I'm now selling the Adderall. And I go into my friend's, well, I'm sitting in my dorm room. My friend walks in. And as I'm sitting there playing FIFA, this kid walks across the room and he just has this huge smile on his face and he pulls out a baggie from his pocket. And I look at him. I'm like, what is it? And he's holding up this baggie and he's shaking them. And I just see these little baby blue pills on the bottom of the baggie. And I asked him, I'm like, what is that? And he's like, they're called blues. I never had heard of it. Never knew what it was.
He's Viagra.
Like, yeah. He goes, they're painkillers. It's like you're stoned, but better. And I said, oh, fuck yeah. Sign me up. He puts this 30 milligram oxycodone on the desk, breaks it in half, slides me the 15 milligrams, slides 15 milligrams over for himself. Cost me $15 to buy that pill. I take my $20 bill, which I was about to give to him, break it down with a credit card, chop it up into a line, roll up that 20, snort it, and immediately, I don't know, give it 2 minutes with the drip hitting me, 5 minutes fully to take effect. I felt the sense of relief and euphoria that I had never experienced in my life. I mean, it was better than sex. It shut off every emotion, every element of trauma, grief, shame, embarrassment, gone. I knew, and that was the scariest part of it. Not the high that I had felt. It was knowing immediately, this is it.
Did it ever get that good again?
Never.
Yeah, that's what everybody...
I mean, it's never going to be as good as the first time, but I mean, there were moments where it was really good, but never as good as that
first one. Yeah.
And
yeah,
the way it hit me, it was like, I just remember how it just shut everything off. And I was like, finally, like, I was no longer the 9/11 kid.
So you're a sophomore.
Sophomore.
And you do the line of a 15 milligram oxy.
Yep.
And a year or so later, what happens that it blew up?
Within weeks, I'm addicted to them. So, like, basically, I snorted the half of the 30 milligram. So, OxyContin is what started this opioid epidemic. And at the time, they were...
By the way, for viewers who don't know this, OxyContin is the long-acting oxycodone, which is an opiate. Oxycodone with, they call them Percocets, or 5 milligram. They're for people that aren't in the deep end of the pool yet.
Yeah.
But when you get to swim in the deep end and you pass your deep water test, then you get OxyContin,
yeah,
or the higher dosage of oxycodone, 30s, you can get higher milligrams than that. You get hundreds.
Well, so yes and no. I'm going to have to fact check you.
Well, I'm going to be the authority on this.
Okay, so OxyContin came out 20 milligrams, 10 milligrams, 40 milligrams, 80 milligrams, and 160 milligrams, which lasted maybe weeks. What people realized after a short period of time was you suck the time coding off of those OxyContin. OxyContin was the brand name for oxycodone extended release, as you said. And the theory was, you know, someone who has chronic pain or cancer takes an 80 milligram OxyContin in the morning. And every hour for the next 8 hours, 10 milligrams will be released. It didn't take long for addicts to figure out. You suck the coating off, you break down that pill, you get 80 milligrams in one shot. And so I knew about OxyContin, but they were gone when I was introduced to oxycodone. Same active ingredient, Blues, as they were called, or Roxy's, did not have Tylenol, which are...
Right. You can't take too much of that.
I always mix the two up. Percocets are oxycodone with Tylenol, and Vicodin are oxycodone with Advil.
Yeah.
The ingredient of Advil. I'm probably switching them, but that's what they are. Anyway, oxycodone, that was what I was doing, Blues. And so 30 milligrams, they had 15 milligrams, 20 milligrams, and 10s. No one wanted those. Once you're doing 30s, 30s were the most, you know, the highest. Funny story.
Well, if you didn't have the 30s, you'd take the other ones.
You would take the other ones, yeah. But for me, like, I did that 15 half of the 30 milligram, 15 milligrams, and it was, I knew, right? The next day I got more, the next day I got more, and I was hooked within a week. And
how many milligrams did you get up to before you were done?
In my peak, 900 milligrams a day.
You're second highest I've ever heard.
Sickening. Who's the highest?
1,300.
1,300? 1,300
a day. Somebody that was in my treatment center with me.
So, you know, it was all about, like, if I had unlimited money, I would think it would, I mean, this is the thing, like, I act like I had unlimited money and I didn't. My peak was basically anywhere between 25 pills to 30 pills a day, which sounds like a lot, but as any addict and alcoholic knows, once you hit that level of keep going and the progression, it's nothing. I mean, I was doing 4 or 5 pills in a line.
There's an expression, one drink is too many, 1,000 not enough.
Yeah, exactly.
It fits here, because if you had 25, it would have been better to have 26 or 30.
I mean, that was the thing. I used to try to buy in bulk, and I would say it was going to last me for the weekend, and like, I would be so knocked on my ass. Next thing I know, I wake up, 35 of them are gone, and I'm like, how the... And it's sickening to think about. And the money, I don't even want to get started with the money, but I had God intervene in my life, and my dad, for sure, numerous times. I mean, I switched over to heroin, but not fully. Right. I had a lot of encounters with heroin.
Were you shooting?
I shot up one time. And this is a story that I tell. It's not in the book. I have two stories that I wrote and took them out of the book. I wish I can go back and put them in.
Is this a Crosstalk exclusive?
This might be. It might be in another interview here and there, but I think you might be the first actually to have this aired. I got OxyContin, the original Oxys. I had a dealer who hit me up and he said, I want to go in on a deal with you. I got this old guy in Brooklyn. We're going to go into Brooklyn. We're going to buy these pills. He's been hoarding these Oxys for years. And I was like, let's do it. So at this point, these pills have been off the market for about 4 years, off the streets for 4 years. And I equate this to like the Jordan Belfort, Wolf of Wall Street, Lemon scene, because that's what it was. I had always heard about OxyContin and all the old... We called them, in where I went to college and at Villanova, they called them J's, which is a Philadelphia term, Jaunts, J's for short. And the old J, we called them J-heads. Anyone who was doing them was a J-head, all right? The kids who were before my time, the old school J-Heads were doing OxyContins. These guys are now in rehab, sober years, you know, maybe still ripping and running a few of them, but there was no OxyContins anymore. So we would look at them and like glorify it and like be like, that is the best. Like, I wish I could do the originals, right? So when I got that call, I was like, sign me up. And I went to Brooklyn with this guy and we got 240 milligram OxyContin pills and 280s.
How many? 240 of them.
240 milligrams pills.
200.
And then 280 milligram pills. I thought you were trying to make a joke.
No, this is...
You did, right?
This was actually the first time that I haven't done that. I thought you were talking about we got 240 milligram.
Yeah, so basically...
My ears.
Exactly.
I deserve to be called out on that.
In the car, I did four 40s, which was about my normal dose of a session of blues, four to five blues, so 120, 150 milligrams at a time. Four of those 40, so 160 milligrams, had me knocked on my ass harder than those four or five blues ever did. And I was like, holy shit. I mean, this was like, it was unbelievable. I mean, the best way I can compare OxyContin was like, it was right on par with heroin. I mean, heroin to blues, yeah, it's the same thing. It's an opiate. It's going to get you high. It's going to get you fixed, you know, get your fix.
It's the same though.
But it was not the same. And like back then, you know, the heroin that I did was junk. You know, there was no fentanyl. Like every addict like wants the best thing that's going to make people... We're sick people. We chase, when we find out someone overdosed, we want that bag. We want that drug. Like, we're sick.
Did you ever see the scene where Chrissy shoots heroin in Sopranos?
Yeah.
He's an amazing actor, Imperioli.
He portrays it so well.
That is
the only thing that they did was they had him use a horse syringe or something. Like, I mean, like, no one's shooting up with those gigantic
that
things.
Scene, I was sober watching that.
Yeah.
And... it made me very uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I'll be honest. I'm a diehard Sopranos fan, and I've watched that show in active addiction. I used to watch it when I was using during those scenes, and when I got sober, I used to watch it. And I've watched it, the series through again recently. And
Trigger.
I wouldn't say that I'm like trigger, but it definitely makes me uncomfortable. Yeah. You know. But anyway, so that's story number one, exclusive for Crosstalk. And story number two is when I shot up. And I had a friend, you know, as we all do. We always have a friend that we rip and run with.
Dear friends.
Yeah. And they're just the most genuine people, right?
I'm sure before you left this morning, you called to see, tell them you're okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So he was the type of friend I would use with for 3 or 4 days at a time and then not hear from him for a month. And basically, we go on a deal together. I needed blues. He was getting heroin. He gets me my blues. I give him some money so he can buy some heroin. The next time, I'm running into the same situation. I ask him again. This time it's around Christmas time. Pharmacies are closed earlier. Doctor's offices are closed. People aren't getting scripts written. So there's a shortage of blues. I can't get them anywhere. I call him up. I say, hey, I need you to hit up that same dealer. And let's go do what we did last time. So we go. And he's acting all weird in the car. And I took some of the money that I had from Christmas and I tucked it in my other, in my underwear. And I had the money that I was going to use to buy the blues in my hand, just in case. I had a gut feeling something was going to go wrong. And so we go to a hood that I wasn't going to pick up typically. And we pull up to the dealer and my friend, we're in the middle of a very dangerous, and I've been in some dangerous places, but this one was dangerous. And this kid was not like, the toughest kid, right? But he was, he had some balls, but he got out of the car. And you don't get out of the car. Like, they come in your car, they come to the window. You don't get out of the car. This kid gets out of the car and walks up to the Project Gate house, like the entryway, the gate. Project House Gate is what I meant to say, sorry. And he's standing there talking to the dealer. And I'm like, what the fuck is going on? He comes back to the car and he's like, he'll be back in a sec. He comes up to the car. He hands me the baggie of the pills. I hand him the money. The last time we did it, my friend goes shine the light on the baggie, make sure that the pills look good. This time he just drives off. And I found that odd. So immediately I pull out my phone and I look, and they're broken in a half of leaves. And I look at him and I'm like, you fucker. Like, you set me up because you owed that dealer money. So he took my money to pay back his dealer. Luckily for me, I kept some money on the side. So I'm like, well, what do we do now? let's go pick up some heroin because we're going to do that for you anyway. I gave him what I had. We bought a brick of heroin, which the way they do it in New Jersey and maybe New York, I don't remember, but they do it by bundles. So 10 bags is a bundle. So we bought 50 bags. And I took my heroin. He took his. I sniff it. And he's sniffing it. And then we get back to my house. And as we get back to my house, he pulls a backpack out of the trunk. I'm like, all right, whatever. Go in my basement so my mom doesn't see us. And when we're sitting in the basement, he opens up the backpack and he starts taking out all his supplies. And I look at him and he goes, looks at me and he goes, do you care if I shoot up? And I said, no. I vowed that I would never do heroin. Obviously, at this point I was. But I also said I'd never put a needle in my arm. I had no problem snorting things. I was a chimney. I would snort everything. I said, I will never put a needle in my arm. And I watched this kid that I went to high school with, that I was close with, shoot up in my basement. And I watch it happen, and I'm looking at him as he's starting to fall out, and I'm like, I want to feel that. I want to feel that. And I asked him, do you have another needle? And he said, no. I said, fine, shoot me up with yours. So he does the whole entire process, right? And I'm looking away as he's shooting me up, and then I look, and he shoots me up, and I fall out myself. He picks me up, puts me on the couch in the basement, puts a blanket over me, and that's what I felt metaphorically and physically, a warm blanket over me. That's what I felt. He puts the blanket over me. The next day I wake up, he's gone. Where'd he go? Start calling him. Not picking up. Over and over and over, he picks up. Yo, where do I get needles? He goes, just go to the pharmacy, go up to the pharmacist, ask him for insulin syringes. I said, okay, fine. I am so strung out at this point. I get in the car and I drive to the CVS that my family had been filling prescriptions for 30 years. Not just my immediate family, but my extended family. And I walk in there and I walk up to the pharmacist and I said, I need insulin syringes. And he looks at me and he knows me and he goes, I can't give you these. I'm like, what do you mean? And my friend told me to say like this, you know, the gauge and all this stuff. And I'm like, I need this. And I start reading it off. He's like, you need a prescription. And I was like, what? He goes, you can't buy needles here over the counter. CVS is the only pharmacy in the country that you cannot walk into and buy needles over the counter. If I had walked into a Walgreens, into a Rite Aid, into any other pharmacy, I would have walked in there, I would have purchased the needles, no problem, and walked out. I walk out of that CVS that day, I walk back to the car, I'm like, all right, fuck it. And I just continue snorting the heroin that I had, and I got sober 2.5 months later. To me, that was my dad, that was God completely intervening, because I know, if I had gotten him that day, it was game over.
I have to tell you, I'm rarely speechless. Thank you for sharing that. I understand exactly what you wanted, why you wanted it. I shouldn't say that. Why you needed it. And boy, was that lucky.
Yeah.
You won't call it a spiritual act, maybe a divine act or something. Whatever it was, it's probably saved your life.
And I'll tell you, the most beautiful piece of that story is because that gentleman knew my father, and he knows my mom very well. My mom ran into him. So when I got sober and I wrote the book and my book came out, I left a lot of stories out of the book because my editor said, you don't need to have every single drug story that you did in the book. And they were right. I probably could have removed some of the stupid ones I kept in there and put the bigger ones like this in there. But in any event, I started telling my mom everything. I don't know what it was. I had been sober at that point when I told her these stories, maybe 6 years, and I just wanted to tell her everything. Like anything that I kept off the table, I'm like, here's everything, Mom. I have no secrets to hide from you anymore, you know? And I have nothing to be ashamed of. And she knew, because she knows my friend's mom very, very well, and she knew what he was doing, and she knew I was doing it too, but she didn't know I put a needle in my arm. And when I told her that story, and I told her the story with the pharmacist, she, ironically, I kid you not, a week later, runs into the guy. He's retired. And she asks him, do you remember this? And she tells him the story. And he goes, yeah, I remember. I vividly remember that. And she goes, you saved his life. And like literally like, and she told him like, I just celebrated 6 years at that point. And it was beautiful because he really did save my life. Like there is no doubt in my mind. Like, and I get very emotional telling that too, because it's the truth. Like, you know, you have people, if I say that story in a room, 9 times out of 10, like an addict, an alcoholic will understand that story. I'll have one person who will try to fact check me. Like, look, if I wanted to make myself seem like the most the baddest, toughest drug addict that ever existed. I would say that I was shooting up heroin for all my addiction when I switched over, right? I say how it is. I didn't switch over fully. I'm lucky, by the grace of God, that I wasn't an intravenous drug addict from that point on. Because I'll tell you, there were people all around me at that time that I was ripping and running with who were putting needles in their arm every single day. And, you know.
What age were you when you got sober?
So I got sober at 23 years old. And what happens is I graduated from college. I was working in Manhattan. I was making money, and it was not enough. My bank account was perpetually in the negative. Paycheck comes in, it wipes out the negative. Like, I had no savings, no nothing, like nothing to my name.
And you were working in finance.
I was working in finance. I worked in Manhattan.
You didn't have a calculator, or how did that do?
So I get arrested in November of 2014.
For?
Speeding. They pulled me over for speeding, and they smelled drugs on me and other alcohol. But they smelled the weed primarily. I was very fucked up. Miraculously, I watched the video of my lawyer. I mean, I was driving fine. I was going 50 and a 40. So it's 11:30 p.m. on a Tuesday night. Those cops had nothing better to do. They pull me over, see a kid in a suit and tie. They're thinking, all right, like, I don't know. We're going to get this guy for a speeding ticket. Well, they fucking hit the gold mine.
DUI?
They didn't give me a DUI. So what happened was they asked me to get out of the car. I understand what's going on. When they come to the driver's side, they ask me where I'm going, where I'm coming from. I answer the questions. They come to the passenger side. This is a busy street, but not at this time of night. Come to the passenger side, start asking me the same questions, and I'm realizing they're trying to catch me in a lie. And I'm like, yeah, fuck. They're going to get me here. They asked me to step out of the vehicle, asked me if I had anything to drink. I said, no, lie. They said, have you smoked? I don't know how they worded it, but they asked me if I smoked weed. And I said, no. And they said, well, it smells like weed in the car. I get out of the car, they bring me to the trunk, and they said, we're going to get a canine unit here. We're going to call the prosecutor and get a warrant to search the car. I said, okay, yeah, get the warrant. And they do. And they come maybe, I don't know, you know, I lost track of time when this is going on, right? Call it 25 minutes, 30 minutes later. It wasn't long. They come, and the canine unit hits on the car immediately. And when they hit on the car, they open up the driver's side door, and in the side pocket paneling, whatever you want to call that, I have 3 ounces of weed Ziploc baggie, and I have my pills in a bottle. Now, if I had taken that pill, like, I didn't think. I was on oxys, Xanax, ketamine, cocaine, alcohol, and weed.
But otherwise, you had nothing in you.
Correct.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm not trying to say that to sound cool. Like, I just was doing everything that night. I was with these dealers at this trap house, and they had all this stuff, and I'm just doing everything. I'm a garbage disposal. And, I was just so slow, you know? Like, if I had thought, obviously, what ifs, right? If I had taken the pills, dumped them in my pocket, or just taken the pill bottle itself and put it in my suit jacket pocket, they never searched me. They never searched me. So I get out of the car, and they're like, I'm standing there waiting for the canine unit. I'm not under arrest yet. And I remember it was November. It was a little chilly. I'm standing there. I'm like, all right, like, when are they going to come? And when they hit the car, they open it up. They get all the weed immediately, obviously. And this is before it was a misdemeanor. And they get the pill bottle. And they start shaking up the pill bottle, and the cop thought it was Molly. I don't know why, but he thought they were Molly's. They arrest me. They bring me to the station, and they're trying to identify the pills, and I told them they were Adderall because I actually was prescribed my Adderall still. And the Adderall that I was taking were 10-milligram pills that were blue, but they're way, way bigger than the oxys. I told these cops, because they seemed like a bunch of dumb idiots, I was like, they're Adderall pills. I'll come back tomorrow. This is my genius. I'm like, I'll come back tomorrow. I'll bring you my prescription. Just give me my pills. And they go, I'm plugging in the identifier, like the what it says on the pill, and it's coming up as oxycodone 30 milligrams. So I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, they weren't click. It wasn't clicking for them. They couldn't understand. So finally, they print up my summons, and they gave me, they charged me with intent, possession, Schedule 1 and Schedule 2, narcotic, and intent to distribute. And the intent was coming from the quantity of the pills and also the quantity of the weed, but also the paraphernalia. They tried to charge me paraphernalia. And then I begged at that point. Like, I didn't get super desperate, but I was like, please, man, I'm going to be in withdrawal. Like, can you just give me a couple of those pills? Just a couple. You already charged me with a felony. Just give me a couple. Because, like, more than 5 pills was a felony. That's what I was told. and I had 55 or 51. I was like, just give me four of them, five of them. Just get me, let me get through the night. And I don't know how it happened, but they literally gave me my summons and they brought me back to my car and I drove home. And I searched, I rummaged through every single drawer I had in my room. I had Suboxone where I knew where that was, but I wasn't going to take it. I found a few Xanax bars that I tucked away.
For people that don't know, Suboxone prevents you from going into withdrawal.
Which I already was in withdrawal at that point. So right. I could have taken the Suboxone and been fine, but that to me was waving the white flag and surrendering. And so I popped my Xanax bars and I went to bed. And the next day had a dealer who had fronted me those pills, by the way, come to the house and give me some more. And I had to give him a certain amount of money by a certain time or I was screwed. And
so did you get a charges, multiple charges, including felonies, misdemeanors, and you're calling you the dealer. Did you call a lawyer also?
Called my uncle, my dad's brother, the next day.
He's a lawyer?
He's a lawyer, not a criminal lawyer. And so I told them that I got arrested for weed. We got on a phone call with a criminal attorney, and they started telling me to read off the charges. So I'm reading them off, and they're like, well, if you got charged with Schedule 1 is oxys. If you got charged with Schedule 1, that's not weed. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I also got arrested for having 50 oxys on me. And my uncle was like, what? And starts freaking out, and he's like, you know. And it was pretty apparent at that point that I was struggling, but they didn't know what I was really doing, you know.
Now, I know a little bit about your story. You talk a little bit about a spiritual experience.
Yeah.
This doesn't sound like a spiritual experience.
The spiritual experience came about 8 months later.
8 months later. So at this point, you're a defendant, a criminal defendant. You have a lawyer. You're still using.
Yep.
Didn't get sober around this time.
No.
None of this was bottom material.
My lawyer was a pretty good lawyer, but he wasn't like, you know, you pay your way out of this crime type of lawyer, right? He was like, you're going to have to do something, whether it's going to go to treatment, whether it's going to, you got to do something. You got to make an effort, right? They were spinning it, which this is the truth. I was selling the weed, but they were saying that all the drugs were mine. The weed was for sale. The pills were mine. He told me to go to a treatment center of some sort. IOP, didn't matter what it was. I went to a place where I got an invoice basically for a consultation, and he was able to use that in my favor. It was a place in New York City that told me, we can't treat you and you need help. You're going to die if you don't get help. Because I was so severely addicted to Xanax too. And so basically I get this consultation, and as I walk out, I say, hey, can I get an invoice? They give it to me. I send it to my lawyer, and he starts using that in my favor. We get some of the charges drop down a little bit. I plead to a misdemeanor of some sort. No felony charge on my record. Problem is I got arrested from a car incident. So that's forever on my DMV in New Jersey, apparently. But basically what happens is they sentence me to 1 year probation in New Jersey in April of 2015. And my lawyer tells me within 2 to 3 months, you'll get a notice in the mail. They're going to drug test you. 2 months later, I get the drug test notice in the mail. It says, it was early June. It says your drug test is scheduled for July 22nd, 2015. And I say, okay, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'll figure out how I'm going to, you know, get sober before then. And I don't get sober. And then a week before the test, I call up my dealer, who I knew was on what they call drug court in New Jersey. And I was on conditional discharge. So I asked him, what do you do? Because, you know, you're not sober. And he said, look, they give me a mouth swab test. So I go in there, I drink this detox mouthwash, go in and I wait in the waiting room. They call me in, mouth swab, put it in the vial. It shows I'm clean. I said, okay. We go to a smoke shop. I buy 2 vials of the mouthwash and I buy 2 bags of synthetic urine. And on the morning of the drug test, this is the moment where I knew I was at that jumping off point, right? I was staying with my grandma at the time. And I walked out of her house and I looked at myself in the mirror and I just saw this. I weighed 250 pounds nearly, pale, extreme, obviously overweight, but my face was, I had no life. My eyes were sunken in and I felt so empty. And that was the scary part, was the drugs and the alcohol, that void that was they were filling for so long, it was not being filled anymore. I mean, and that was the scariest thing. I couldn't see my life with it anymore or without it. And I just didn't know who I was. And that's what I thought. Who are you? As I looked at myself in the suit and tie, I had this expensive suit and tie.
What size were you? Let me guess. You were a 46.
Good guess. Good
regular.
Guess. Yep. Good guess.
46 regular.
Good guess.
A 40 waist.
Yeah. probably.
How am I doing? You're in seam. Now that we don't have to go there.
Yeah. Anyway, so I go in for the drug test, and I start drinking the mouthwash in the car as I'm literally getting high in the car. And I go into the waiting room, and I start looking at my watch, and I'm counting down the clean saliva time. And as I get called in, finally, to my probation officer's office to meet with her to take this drug test, I have about 25 minutes of clean saliva. I sit across the desk from her, and she's got the mouth swab in the packaging on her keyboard. Light bulb goes off in my mind, and I was like, this is the easiest con I'm ever going to pull off. Like, literally, I'm sitting there grinning. And she starts shuffling through all these papers, and she looks at me, looks back up, and she goes, are you going to pass this drug test? And I said, yeah, I'm going to pass. She looks back down. You acknowledge that if you fail, we can call DIFUS because you have a brother who's under the age of 18. You acknowledge if you fail, that if you fail this test in this moment, we can send you to jail right now. Yes, yes, yes. I check off all the boxes. I sign my name at the bottom. She looks down, looks back up, looks down, looks back up, and then finally looks down again, grabs a cup, and she says, okay, go pee in this cup. My heart sinks because that fake urine, supposed to be strapped to my leg, is not strapped to my leg. I left it at home. I walk in the bathroom with a gentleman who's supposed to watch me through the head like an angled mirror. And as I start peeing in the cup, I look to my left, and he's not looking through the angled mirror. He's looking the other way, and I'm thinking, shit, like I could have gotten away with it. And I walk back in, and she's holding up the cup now, and it's lit up all around. And, like, this is what I mean. Like, there were things I was taking. I didn't even know how it was. I was ingesting them, you know, substances and things I was failing for. She said, you had 2 months' notice of this drug test. I don't know if this is a cry for help or you genuinely can't stop. And I cut her off, and I said, no, like, I do want to stop. I want to get sober. And she said, okay, fine. I'll give you one more chance. If you come back in 1 month and you're clean and sober, I will drop every charge. But if you come back in 1 month and you fail, I am sending you to jail that day. And I said, okay, deal. I called out of work, and I went home to my mom's house. No one was there. And I paced back and forth, trying to figure out, what am I going to do? Go back in 1 month, fake urine strapped to my leg, drink the mouthwash, foolproof plan that I was supposed to have in place the first time, or just wave the white flag and surrender and say, I need help. I got to get help. And I rolled myself up a joint. I made myself a drink. I walk out into the backyard. I spark up that joint. And I look up in the sky, and it is just so crystal clear blue, like the morning of 9/11. And I start crying. Immediately start crying. And I talked about my dad's premonition 2 weeks before he died. Well, during that two-week span, he talked about when he died that he was going to come back as a fly. On September 12th, my mom was told to look for the signs, and that night a fly landed on her nightstand. That was her sign that my dad wasn't coming home. That fly stayed in our house for 6 months after 9/11. If you're spiritual in any way, we would leave the door open, the window open, it wouldn't fly away. You know, we'd swat at it to make it go out, it wouldn't fly away. And I would have so many visits from that fly in all these years, and we'd see it, and everyone would know and acknowledge it, right? So on that sunny day in July 2015, I'm leaning on this railing, and I'm crying the most genuine, real tears I had cried in a long, long time. And I just said, Dad, please give me a sign. I need some help. It just hit me with so much power and emotion. And this fly lands on the railing I'm leaning against. And it just is moving in a circle over and over and over.
Not flying away.
Won't fly away. And I start swatting at it, won't fly away. And I pulled out my phone, and I recorded this quick little video, and I'm crying in the background, just recording this fly on the railing. And I put my phone away, put out the joint, walked inside the house, took my phone back out, and called up a detox. And I said, look, I'm not sober right now. I need a bed tonight. And they said, we can't get you in until Friday. And I said, okay, fine, book it. I want the bed. 2 days later, I checked myself into detox. That was July 24, 2015. By the grace of God, that's my sobriety date. And I got to detox. I thought the pills, the, you know, the opiates, the Xanax, like that was, it was going to be hard to kick. And it was. I had seizures in there. And if I wasn't under medical supervision, I would have died. But I mean, the physical stuff was one thing. It was what was going to happen in the next couple of months that was going to really be eye-opening for me, you know?
And so this is a spiritual experience. Would you, your dad, I remember you saying your dad used to go to church. The family would go to church all the time. Are you still very connected to the church, or do you find it in other ways?
Somewhat connected to the church still, but I'm very spiritual. Like for me in the program, like my dad is my higher power. It's worked for me since day one. I got to my sober living. They told me you have to pick a power greater than yourself. I said, it's not God for me. They said, well, anything you want. I picked my dad. And look, I had so many visits from my dad. I had so many signs from my dad. I came forward about being abused after my third youngest brother called me and said stuff on that phone call that scared the shit out of me. And I said, look, if that guy's going to do something to me, what he did years ago to someone else, I can't live with myself, let alone my own brother. And so I came forward. And literally when I did visit from the fly, my mom had a visit from the fly. I mean, it was just things you couldn't explain. And you know, he was facing all this time in prison and he got sentenced to 7 years. They pled him out. And I don't know if that's the correct term. You're a lawyer. You would know.
It was a plea bargain.
Plea bargain. Yeah. So they gave him a plea deal, and this plea deal was he would face a max of 7 years. And he got 7 years. He got out in 4. And you know, he's on lifetime parole. He's, you know, Megan's Law, the whole thing. But, I really did hate the system. I resented the justice.
Is there a civil action as well?
You know, at one point I was going to do it, and I never did. Because the guy had nothing. And it wasn't about money. But it was, for me, it was like, you know, I hate to say this. I'm not a vindictive person. But it would be to try to ruin him the way he ruined me.
In a wouldn't sense. Help you.
But it wouldn't help me. And that's the thing. My uncle, my dad's brother, he introduced me to an attorney to do a civil case. We went back and forth. My aunt, who I've now rekindled a relationship with after years, because I really did not have one. She was my godmother. And not because of what happened, but because of how she handled the news. She didn't do things the way I would have wanted her to do them. But that's me trying to control the situation. The point is, I didn't need to put her and my cousins. The relationships between me and them are already torn and honestly severed, probably beyond repair. But I didn't need to put them through more. They were high school kids at the time, mm-hmm. and they were going through their own stuff while in high school, with their dad being all over the news for being a predator, you know, and being in prison. And I felt indirectly responsible for that. And so I didn't want to put them through it. And I was like, you know what? I don't need or want his money. And it's just not worth my energy. And what's it going to do? It's not going to fix anything. It's the same thing for me today. Like, people ask me if I ever want to drink or smoke or do drugs. Kids at schools ask me that all the time. And I literally tell them, yeah, I want to do it when I want to change how I feel. It's a typical thing we say in AA, right? Like, when we want to change how we feel or we're not okay with who we are, that's when we want to get outside of ourselves and escape again, right? But then I remember, it's not going to do anything. It's not going to bring my dad back. It's not going to change the way I feel. If it does, it's temporarily, only temporary. And then what?
My line is that I don't need to do it again because I know how the movie ends. I don't want to watch it again. It's the same exactly. thing.
Same thing.
You know, you do the same thing over and over expecting a different result.
Yep.
There's no different result. It's not like there's going to be a euphoric recall every day. It just doesn't happen that way.
Yeah. Yep.
So one of the reasons, I guess you share what you do about your sexual abuse with your uncle is because holding on to it is, you know, they say you're only as sick as your secrets.
Yep.
But is there anything about this that you think destigmatizes the whole subject of being the victim of sexual abuse? Because you've helped so many people sharing your story, and you do speaking engagements, am I right?
Yeah.
You speak at schools. Why don't you tell Correct. Us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I speak at high schools, and I pivoted from what I was doing before in COVID time. Basically, when my book came out, I started getting requests to speak at schools, and I already had been doing it, but not fully, and I knew how fulfilled I was feeling from doing it, so I just took a leap. You know, we talked about this before. I took that leap of faith that I'm going to go in with, you know, with everything I got, and if I fail, I fail, but you know what? I have it at this point, you know? So last year I spoke over 45 times, 50 times. I had at least one kid in every presentation that spoke up about being abused or assaulted.
That's
crazy to hear. 2 years ago, that wasn't the case. I didn't have kids every single time speaking up. Maybe it's the way I'm telling the story now. Maybe it's the way I'm speaking. I've always been genuine. I never scripted anything, or I just speak from the heart. But there's something that I'm doing now that's allowing them to connect, which is great. But that to me is the gift, because to me, I can have a million diplomas. My gift is my story and my ability to tell it in the way I do. And the kids are able to connect with that. and they know I'm genuine. They can sense I'm authentic, and that is giving them the power to speak up. And that's all I ever wanted. I don't need to go into a school and get a bunch of kids to feel sympathy for me or be proud of me for where I'm at today. I want them to speak up and tell their own story. That's the goal. That's the end goal. Not to go into a school and to educate kids on drug addiction and alcoholism. We can do that till we're blue in the face. It's not going to do anything. It's to get kids to identify what drives them to get outside of themselves. If I had someone come into my school while I was going through being my periods of abuse, it probably could have changed my entire life. Maybe I wouldn't have gone down the path I did with drug addiction. I believe I'm an alcoholic and an addict, and always was, and that it would have showcased itself or surfaced in some other way if it wasn't addiction to drugs. But if someone had told me what I tell these kids now, maybe it would have gotten me to speak up sooner. I mean, I have kids that confide in me about stuff that happened to them when they were 4 years old, 5 years old, like, and they come to me first. And they asked me for advice.
There's two parts about this that are very attractive. One is the subject matter. The subject matter that you're able to share and other people connect with it, identify with it, maybe even go to the point where some of these kids come up and talk about it and they don't have to go through what you went through. The other thing is just when we, regardless of what we've gone through, whether it's sexual abuse or anything else that's traumatic, to be able to be genuine and to be able to open up about it, there's such a freedom that comes with that.
Yeah.
And so while the subject matter may be attention-getting, it's just behaving this way as a regular course of your life and not trying to be somebody that you're not, it makes you want to be with that person because none of us are perfect.
Right.
We're all fucked up in one way or another.
Right.
And if you show that, You're much more attractive to the next person. I want to be around people like that. I want to be around people that are honest.
Yeah, and the thing is, right, like I make it very clear to the kids that I've dedicated my life now to doing this because I know it's gonna help at least one kid. And like, you know, I can go in there and like I said, I do what I did. When I got sober 9 years ago, I was telling my story at schools in New Hampshire and Massachusetts. Totally different thing. It was to go into a school to remove the stigma associated with addiction. So I tell my story. I never talked about the abuse. The moment I talked about the abuse for the first time, I had a kid come up to me. And he said, "You saved my life, and I want to let you know you should write a book." I told him verbatim, "I'm 9 months sober. I'm not even a year sober. I'm trying to save my life one day at a time. But thank you." I was like, "I'll consider writing that book." And that summer, I started writing the book.
In the big book that we use in that program, that 12-step program, it talks about the capacity to be honest as being the single most important thing. If you can't be honest with yourself, you're not going to get sober. I have never met anybody that had a greater capacity to be honest with themselves than you. I want to just tell you, thank you so much for being on Crosstalk, for being a part of our podcast. We're growing, and with interviews like this, we're going to explode. And we want to see more of Matt Bocci on Crosstalk.
Thank you for giving me a platform to tell my story. I don't take that lightly. You know, for what I do and how I do it, it's a privilege for me and it's an honor. And so to believe in my story the way you have and the kind words you've said, it means a lot more to me than you know. So thank you. Thank you for having me on here.
Thanks so much, Matt. Appreciate it.
Thank you.